Okay, this is tape six, side A. And I had asked about the rise of private labs and research, privately funded research, and you just said that you felt that that was probably not a good trend. Did you want to add anything to that, though?
Yeah, it's a biased view because I've been in publicly funded labs and public universities all the way along. Mm-hmm. And none of the labs that I've been in with while I was in them, I don't think we're getting a great degree of funding from private sources. Charles's lab is probably now getting more so. I think that a public research enterprise is one of the great things. It's almost, and I sometimes make the analogy with the position of the monasteries in medieval Europe. There it was, you know, it was sort of a, it was seen as a good thing that generally that these incredibly large, expensive buildings with staffed by thousands of people were put up, and the people were doing what was then viewed as a public function, which was prayer.
Right.
The equivalent now is research. I think where it's more beneficial than prayer, and I think it's the sometimes unspoken compact is that, you know, pay us a little, pay us enough to live okay. We'll do the research, and our obligation is we tell the truth. We don't fudge the data.
Right.
We'll be driven either by our curiosity mostly, but to find out as much as we can about the world, and that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
I'd hate to see that compact lost, and maybe it should, that contract should, that scientists make with the community should be expounded on more, and the idea of what it is to be a scientist. And that idea of we won't fudge the data, we'll tell you the way it is, should be clung to and adhered to more than it is. And I think replacement of that by a business model of doing science can only be bad. People know, especially after the last year,
right,
that you cannot trust yourself in your own business dealings. Even, you know, no one expects a businessman, even an honest businessman, to act in the public interest completely.
Right.
And certainly less so in the last year. So it should be more, I think maybe that's a way in which scientists should communicate with the public. Look, this is the contract we make with you.
You know, so clarify that contract. Make it explicit.
Make it explicit. Yeah. Make it a real contract with America or, mm-hmm, and transnationally, because the other thing, great thing I think about science is that it is transnational.
Mm-hmm.
It is a community that's goes beyond borders, always has been, and should be so. That in time of war, scientists were let cross between countries, data was exchanged.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably gone by the board.
Okay, we'll turn more now to more mundane, I say more mundane, more concrete matters closer to home, and less maybe philosophical. How big is your lab total? Personnel.
Two graduate students, two senior postdocs who now have research scientist appointments, one technician, two undergraduates.
And what is the racial breakup of that group?
We have two people from Korea, and actually, three people from Korea, and even the technician is of Korean descent.
Mm-hmm.
We have somehow got this connection with originally from the postdoc who came here from Seoul National University. So there's, for initially Chancer and thereafter probably somewhat personal connection reasons, that's a big bias in the lab. We've got one of the other postdocs is American and from English-speaking parents. The Koreans are both the graduate students and one of the postdocs. One of the undergraduates is Muslim name, Abia, wearing, I presume, from Muslim parentage. I'm not sure from which country. And the other is American from English-speaking parents.
Mm-hmm.
Over the course of the lab, it's typically for graduate programs at public universities, we've had a lot of, we could have recruited as many Asian students as you could fill up your whole program with Asian students, and it's been limited by the amount of the need to have training grant fundable American students as well, maintain mm-hmm. diversity to keep some fraction of American students.
And what is the breakdown gender-wise? How many women, for instance, do you have in the lab?
It fluctuates. For a little while, some in the past graduate student. I haven't had all that many graduate students, and the graduate students who've been in the lab so far have been two female, one male. Mm-hmm. One of the women left to the master's degree, so the one, male student who will graduate, and one female student who's new in the lab, and I hope will go all the way to a PhD. Postdocs have been three male, one female over the history of the lab. Undergraduates have probably been both biased towards female. Recently, the lab was almost entirely male. Now, with the newer graduate student and new undergrads in the lab, there are more female.
Mm-hmm. And how about in your department? How many female PIs are there? You don't have to give me an exact number, but just sort of a ballpark.
In the immediate department, there's two, and in the extended department, it's one or two more.
Right.
And neurobiology has been seen as one of the departments which have had a problem recruiting and retaining female faculty.
Right.
One of the my immediate person who was hired just before me, just a few months before me, did not get tenure, and she was a female faculty member.
Mm-hmm.
I would perhaps plead a little on the department's behalf that the pool doesn't seem to be all that female-rich, particularly in neurobiology.
Mm-hmm. And in the immediate department, I mean, how many PIs overall are there?
20.
20. Do you feel that women do science differently than men, in your experience?
Perhaps, but I'm hesitant to put it in those gender terms because I don't like the idea of constraining people by genotype. And that's a genotype distinction. So, yes, you could caricature a female and a male mode of doing science, and probably I would say that in the lab where I did my graduate work, there is, in Madison, a very, probably an island of left-wing liberalism in Berkeley of the Midwest.
Yeah.
There were lots of strong and politically aware women generally in the university, and particularly in our lab.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt I was almost a lone male among a strong-minded women. My political views were appropriately shaped.
Mm-hmm.
For the better, probably. But and then when I went to my postdoc lab, the Zirkle lab, and so I felt like it was almost that was you could see the difference in there was sort of a what I call jock science mode, more competitive, people more willing to compete with each other in terms of things like hours spent in the lab and
mm-hmm.
Compete with each other, meet with the investigator, the PI, but. And there are plenty of women, there are men and women in both labs, but I'd say the women probably are more stressed out in the other environment. That said, though, I mean, I felt like it's not necessarily a helpful way of viewing things. I think you should give people the credit for being independent-minded enough, rather than saying, just as well, you shouldn't say, you've got this polymorphism in your serotonin transporter, therefore you should be behaving like this. You shouldn't say, you've got a Y chromosome, therefore you should be behaving like that.
Right.
My tendency has been to, things should be made on a gender-blind basis. You blind, if you think that there is a male or female type of performance that might be better or worse, you should discriminate on the basis of the performance, not on the basis of the genotype.
Right. Well, then that leads real with the next question. I mean, is science, in your experience, both, at every level, graduate, postdoc, and now as PI, has it been gender blind? In other words, is the playing field sort of level between men and women PIs? And graduate students as well.
I think I would guess it's level than in other occupations, but it's still pretty, it can be level, but still pretty bumpy.
Right.
There can be all sorts of local biases, and I would view as, you know, I would always focus on the, be skeptical of broad generalizations and focus on the local biases and the local power relations and the local within the lab, within the within the university. I think that in certain areas here, it's, for instance, in the undergraduate fellowships that my wife helps administer, and it's, females are far favored, especially on, and minority groups are much favored. I've cooperated with all of the those various things because on the whole, the university gets funds, then gets fellowships that it wouldn't get otherwise. But if I probably don't agree at base with anything other than a completely gender-blind, color-blind way of making judgments. Your judgments should be based on performance, not on pre-existing genotype-related things.
Right. All right. Let's turn to race. Questions of race.
We're already there, I guess.
Right, yeah. We're there. But I have to ask this anyway, even if you just say ditto. There are several underrepresented groups in science, African-Americans, Latinos, just to name two. How specifically might more members from these underrepresented groups be brought into science? How can we add more players in this playing field?
in a couple of ways. In the long run, it's got to be, you've got to go right back to early education. Once again, not on the basis of, in this case, genotype, race assignment, which biologically has no meaning, culturally does have a meaning. But the meaning should not. But the cultural distinction of race should not, in my view, determine, be used to make distinctions in government-administered funding. It should be on the basis of performance. If minority groups tend to have fewer resources and fewer means, the distinction should be made on resources and means. But a lot can be done by disseminating information. I think for many of the underrepresented groups, though it's often because of the nature of Stony Brook's population, which is recent immigrants and children of immigrants for a large part, people who come in from the city, from Queens and the nearer city suburbs, they may be overrepresented in our population. I think a lot of them come in with the idea of being a doctor as the pinnacle of ambition. And again, the idea of publicizing the scientific life and the scientific contract, the nature of the contract, and the idea of that as being you can be a success in this way, would be useful. Stony Brook's a big pre-med school. We see a lot, particularly when you teach genetics, you see a lot of all of these people who come in with the ambition of going into medicine. Because in some ways that's the cultural definition of success. I'd say let's try and, you know, broaden those cultural definitions of success a little, as well as providing, where possible, the means for people to succeed. And one of the means to succeed is actually providing a university like Stony Brook with relatively low tuition. Making it a friendlier place to minorities could possibly help, but not being a member of a quote underrepresented unquote minority, I'm not sure how to do that.
Right.
It always felt funny, especially when I was at Madison, where I think it was to my knowledge about 25 Irish people in town, and yet I was always part of the overrepresented majority, whereas there were thousands and thousands of Asian students, for instance, in town. It was the quote, had that Madison had the largest minority representation. It seems sort of oxymoronic to an oxymoronic definition, but I guess there are reasons why. There are, again, it for me it goes back also to not being a prisoner of history. There are historical reasons why cultural minorities are underrepresented, but I don't think that you can go from the general to the particular and make discriminations between people today in this generation for historical reasons.
All right. So affirmative action is not going to solve this problem then, to your mind?
I don't think so, because I think it focuses the tends to focus resources on the very the privileged or members of them of the minority.
Right.
The people who will, people will collect fellowships. You know, very few students will. But we have. I'd rather see. And it's true that there are under-recognized minorities who, because of the way that anytime you create a minority, you've got to make a definition on paper. And those definitions do not match the real world. So there are you're going to leave people out that should not be left out.
But let's say if we accept then that, you know, this is a sort of race, is a cultural term. Nevertheless,
a very U.S.-specific cultural term.
It really does. Yeah, it really is. Like that's true. But given, regardless of its artificiality, its cultural foundation, nevertheless, it has real results.
I'm not at all quarreling with the reality of it.
Right, right.
And in some ways, one of the paradoxes, I say, you know, in some ways, it's getting easier to change your genotype. Genotypic inheritance than it is your cultural inheritance. Believe me, I'm Irish. I know how difficult it is to change one's cultural baggage. So I don't at all quarrel with the real effects of a cultural concept.
Right. And I mean, and this is a hard question. I don't expect, I mean, people have been wrestling with this for a long time. Affirmative action, you know, by your reasoning, will not work. Is there anything then, though, that can be done to overcome these cultural hurdles, I guess? And bring people again back into science, people who don't have that opportunity now.
You have to be sure that there is. So the one place where you could make where it is would be justifiable to make distinctions is in asking the questions of, you know, is it really true that we have no institutional racism, that. That people are not as favored, but it's very hard to, you know, you have most of these look at a pipeline of progression to a career and ask, you know, identify a greater or lower representation of a particular class as you go through that career and ask why. And you can, it's so much easier to identify the phenomenon than to figure out the why, because the results are so personal, their reasoning can be so personal in each case.
In one way, it feels a little unfair for me as to ask you, you know, a native Irishman, to talk about, you know, basically what is, as you said, you know, a congenital American problem, but.
Well, in some ways, the Irish are only free from this problem because they've been insulated from it. And they have a long and sorry history of being among the forefront of racists, both when they've come over here, and also right at home now in Ireland, people are dealing with this for the first time. Their first time they're getting influx of Eastern European immigrants, and they've had for a long time an underclass that have been labeled, you know, it doesn't take much to physically label a class as distinct, but there are a class of people called tinkers or itinerants or traveling people, depending on which, on the scale of political correct nomenclature, that have been discriminated against. And so that problem exists there too. Language is a where there is a language difference, it's a big issue. Mm-hmm. And yet, science is one area in which you can succeed quite a lot despite considerable language difficulties. As you know, I know because I've had Korean students and Korean postdocs in my lab who are doing well despite right. And real observable language difficulties. I think to pick I keep coming up against the difficulty of dealing with this in a general concept.
Yeah.
I can't and won't make distinctions that of with as broad a brush as underrepresented minority. That for me has little meaning in reality. Even though the concept is real, the problem has to be dealt with in particularities. Which underrepresented minority? Which person?
Right.
What exactly is the problem for a person? Is it that they don't have enough money? Then let's make sure that people with not enough money, rather than people who are a minority, can get access to funding for fellowships or scholarships right. or graduate school. Is it that there is a language problem? Let's provide the classes that you need in order to get up to speed in scientific English.
Right.
Is it racism? But that can be as much a feeling of coming to a different country is a difficult thing, and for people coming from some minority communities here must be something similar when you come to a research university. Must be something like coming to a different country, but there's a certain amount of adaptation that has to go on both sides.
Right.
You do have to, it's undeniable, you have to give up some of your culture when you do that. I had to give up a lot of culture when I came to the US, a lot of my identity, and it's always a source of tension.
Right.
And the great benefits of coming here to a country that's big enough and homogeneous enough to mount a huge public research enterprise, which is the reason I'm here, the costs are you're going to lose some of your identity, your cultural identity, and that has to be allowed for. You gain a lot too. You gain freedom. You gain freedom from your historical constraints. Other than the general, you know, to go back to that issue of with that question I asked the class about the polymorphism, which should we provide for people on the basis of genotype? I think the distinction that I ended up making was you try and maximize access to knowledge for everybody and identify obstacles that prevent access to knowledge based on non-genotype related things, but draw the line at making distinctions among people or preferentially rewarding people based on things other than performance.
Right. What is the best part? An easier question to talk about. What is the best part about being a scientist?
You never leave the playground. It's all right. An extended period of juvenile delinquency.
Right.
It's this stuff that's making it's a livelihood, and at the same time, it's exploration. It's finding out. I mean, how few people, the tiny percentage of people in each generation who have been explorers. You get to be an explorer.
Mm-hmm.
It's on the good days, it's finding out something different at the world. Having that sense, that sort of satisfying curiosity. There's no. Curiosity is one of those basic human drives. It's satisfying it is always good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, the consequences are good or not, the feeling of satisfying it is
right.
good.
How about the other side of the coin? What is the least pleasant part of your job?
Feeling that I'm swamped, that I'm so many degrees away, you know, whether because of nested interruptions or so many tasks removed from actually having my hands in contact with the real world at the bench. Is one. I'd say that's it. There's a certain frustration that comes again with the tension between family and work. That feeling of never being able to do anything really well.
Right.
That I used to find satisfaction in, that kind of liking for the craft aspects of science. It means taking the time to do something really well, even perhaps even better than it need be done. But that's also that's part of being on the cutting edge of science. You know, the first day, new data is rarely clean.
Mm-hmm.
It's usually fuzzy, and it's figuring out the fuzziness is part of the puzzle. That's pleasant.
What were the consequences on you in your lab of the Pew Grant?
For me personally, it was an enormous morale booster. Right, I got it at a stage when we were still stuck in the positional cloning stages and just beginning to get a break on one of the first genes we cloned, and we hadn't really produced anything. And I was not. It was validation for the worth of the work that, for me personally, was was one of those. Whether it was or just around that time that I got the grant, but it was before and after view, hearing about that grant and getting it is one of the things. Before, things looked awfully cloudy. Afterwards, they seemed a lot brighter.
Right.
In fact, it enabled the, in NIH grant terms, it was sort of a half a grant. The grant and that grant and a half level was about the ideal level of funding for the lab, and has been for the past couple of years, and since we've got this polycystin related grant, in the sense that has taken the place of the amount in funding that the Pew Grant provided, and we're now at the stage, I think, where we could expand to two full NIH grants if we manage to get it. I'm not sure that we will, but
mm-hmm.
Probably the lab has developed. I feel like I haven't given back as much to the Pew in terms of the scientific productivity that they expected, but I think it's just a slower developing. For me, I'm a slower producing scientist. It probably takes a year or two longer for the input money to produce the papers than for other, in part because of my character, in part because of the nature of the work that I started.
Mm-hmm.
So in the long run, I feel like if I can produce the papers over the next couple of years, that'll actually be the seed money was the Pew for at least two of those papers that, even though that funding has expired now.
Mm-hmm.
Having flexible funding, having funding where you could get it, roll it over and extend it for a year, that also helped.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we're at the end of the question set, and usually we end with opening that, or giving you the mic rather, and letting you say anything that you wish, anything that you'd like to add that hasn't
not that
been
I found up. It terribly constraining so far,
or maybe clarify anything too.
I'm just looking back over kind of word notes and cue words that I'd scribbled down, seeing if I'm. So this is an example of how I'll find it easier to react to a question than to say something. I come up with something independently. I've, of course, I'm probably struck by the disconnect between maybe what I'm saying and the way other people in the lab would perceive me.
Right.
So, you know, like my wife was saying, are you going to tell them exactly how much of a control freak you are? And this hands-off management style is all sort of... So, in wondering about this process, I've got a scientist skepticism that a one-person report has any objective meaning whatsoever. On the other hand, I was wondering today it must be strange having each people give what they view as their unique feelings, and I bet you've got people classified into, oh, this is a type 3B, we're going to have another. I know how exactly this is going to go. The whole philosophical issue of human uniqueness that we've talked about,
right,
and the self is something I still find puzzling. I remember, right back when I was very young, I'd go into, here I am, this is me thinking about being me, this is me thinking about being me, going into that regress, and then thinking, I wonder how many other people think like this.
Mm-hmm.
And, that idea of, which is, common to everyone and yet ultimately unanswerable, I'm sure to many people I would have appeared, particularly when I was younger, as pretty solipsistic and living in my own little world, and self-contained. But a lot of it was trying to ask that question. Do other people think the same? How weird am I anyway?
Right, where do I stand?
And later on, I think I reviewed, the sense that I wanted to expected science and wanted science to provide fame and fortune. One of the ways I expressed it is, I want to be so famous that people will call me eccentric instead of wacko. And I wonder whether science has been wonderful in that way, in that, it's given somebody who is, that's me, who viewed as pretty socially inept, pretty intellectually able up to a point, but not all that much. Self-contained, given the tools to interact with the world and ultimately to interact with other people, mm-hmm, in a way that's productive and semi-productive and, I think is on the whole, hopefully in the long run, contributes. Still, one worries about as you get to be more secure and tenured, perhaps, rather this just gives your eccentricities free rein, and takes off some of the filters, so that you become less socially rather than more socially adept. But I think on the whole, it's good not needing to worry about it.
Right. I remember William Blake saying something about the road to wisdom being excess, or in some sense, being allowed maybe to follow those whims and eccentricities in some respects.
Or moderation in all things, especially moderation.
Right.
I'd say my goals are still as lofty as they were.
Right.
But they weren't always lofty. They weren't all that lofty to begin with. I don't have grand ambitions. I remember I was asked to, in school, I think one essay was, who are your heroes? Well, actually, I don't really have any heroes. Too much of an Irishman or maybe a North Dubliner to really respect anyone to that extent. You're always skeptical.
Right.
And I was asked the question again by my sister-in-law, who's also been, for a while, interviewing scientists for unrelated reasons, and was asked the question in an email, identify which scientists would you think identify and suspect as political leaders who you as scientists would respect and would be able to convey this particular message that she was interested in having conveyed. I'm from New York now, I don't respect anyone.
No.
Well, Maybe Harold Varmus, but only because he bikes to work.
Right.
There was, I think something, an issue that I'm not sure that we've is related to what we've touched on was, that I also think about scientists as an elite, the extent to which you're allowed think of yourself as an elite. And, you know, I was brought up in educated in a high school that was having this conflict, you know, whether were they educating the elite or were they, and that was, they were educating the elite, there was no question about that, was that a good or a bad thing? Anytime you make something, you know, one of my mottos, or not mottos, but mantras, involuntary mantra, has always been judge not lest ye be judged, because I've always been afraid of being judged, feeling inadequate.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, particularly since I've become a faculty member, so much of the job is making judgments. You're grading, you're saying, you know, who's in the top of the class, who do I want in my lab, who should get this undergraduate scholarship and who should not get it, who should get this grant and who should not get it. It's judgments all the way. Mm-hmm. Always with imperfect data, always with real consequences. I'm fed up with it. I'd much rather not have to grade at all. The graduate genetics course I organize, the students are so much more concerned with the grades of the courses than they should be at a graduate school level.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we should be just able to teach them the knowledge for its own sake at this stage. And anyone in graduate school should be motivated enough to get that we should not have to grade this course. I would much rather not grade it.
Right.
And yet, the school requires the graduate students maintain a B average for, therefore, that something must come out of it. You can make obvious distinctions among, you know, there's a small fraction of students who should not be in graduate school, and it's our duty to identify them as early as possible so they don't waste their own time as well as everyone else's.
Right.
And get more demoralized as they go on. So the necessity of making judgments is something that's both about people, is something that I don't like having to do. I have this, on one hand, this view of science as something that everyone ought to be able to do, and it would be great if, and part of it is, you don't really understand what science is about until you've done it to some extent. Until then, a scientist is a cartoon figure in a white coat.
Right.
Until you get the idea of figuring out about how the world works by experiment, it's hard to grasp that. And that may be a limit to the extent to which scientists can educate the public, the extent to which the public don't identify themselves as scientists because they don't see themselves as able to master this arcana of knowledge. I would rather see science not become professionalized in that way.
Mm-hmm.
I guess getting undergrads, at least as many undergrads into labs as possible, is one way of doing it. But then, you know, it's obvious when you do science, there are some people with an aptitude for it and some not. And it's hard to admit that sometimes, that mm-hmm. there are people who are never going to be able to do science. There are people who are much better at it than others. Remember somebody quoting one of Jim Watson's quotes to me, you know, that they admired a lot and found it was, you know, it's very important not to hang around with stupid people. But I found that offensive and still do.
Sounds elitist.
It is elitist.
Right.
And there is a truth to it, but it also, you know, my retort was there are many kinds of stupidity, mm-hmm. and uttering that is one of them.
That's good.
But there are also many ways of doing science. I think of my own way of doing science as somewhat atypical. It's a little less analytical.
Mm-hmm.
It's more associative, more imaginative in a fuzzy way, maybe, and not in a. I find it hard to master the, say, details of a signal transduction pathway.
Mm-hmm.
But do find it helps, and I would like writing out maps and putting things in concrete, physical concrete terms, and manipulating them in physical terms. So I do think there are different ways of doing science, and you have to allow for all of them. In some ways, when we're talking about gender in science, I think it's important not to constrain people, identify people and expect them to perform in a certain way because of their overt genotype and overt phenotype, and also to allow for the different ways that science can be done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if somebody finds it hard to produce a restriction map one way, you don't insist that they produce it that way. Maybe there's a different way for them to think about it. For me, I find, you know, maybe from, I can take on board and identify words, text, phrases. In some ways, I do my sequence analyses by identifying, you know, even trying to pronounce the way strings of amino acids would feel. Oh, I know that's that DVDVVLI, that sort of region. There's another one. That I can do, which is nonsensical in some ways, but it's just a tool. It's a way of grappling with data.
Mm-hmm.
There are all sorts of people bring their own differences and strengths to doing science, and that ought to be allowed for. Rambling a bit too much here. Turned 40, so, and I think, you know, started saying to explicitly to myself, I don't feel like I am get away with being young anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel like I can, I don't want to hear my self described as promising anymore. It's time to put up or shut up. I've got to, and things have gone along, skated far too long, got by for too long on that sort of promise that actually hasn't produced.
Mm-hmm.
So some productivity is needed over the next few years, even to justify my way of doing science.
Right.
Yeah, still haven't figured out whether I'm how I got here, whether it was the path of least resistance, whether I have at the same time the feeling that things have been pretty easy for me all along, that I have had these opportunities,
right.
That the few big decisions I've had to make did not involve a great deal of sacrifice on my part. And yet, I can see more clearly, perhaps even after this process now, that many of the traits and this drive I have done, it wasn't just a random process, that I was had this by temperament and inclination and curiosity.
Right.
You can see how it was directed in a sense, even when I wasn't aware of it. In some way, when you have children, it becomes clear. It's fascinating to see your traits in the same way that you recognize your parents in yourself, recognizing yourself appearing in your children in some ways and not in others.
Well, it touches the question too of serendipity, which I didn't ask, which I should have. What role has serendipity played in your career and in your research?
So, no, you did ask that.
I did. Okay.
And I answered it in two ways then. One was to the concept of anti-serendipity, which I felt at a fairly shallow level, I felt that we hadn't got lucky breaks in our cloning.
Right.
That I had been very lucky in the people that I'd got into the lab.
Okay.
And in lucky chance, you know, lucky chances interfering with coming into my life, the fact that Karen's aunt lived beside my mother's cousin that was is the reason, in one sense, that I'm married to the person I'm married to now, which, you know, the choice of a, and not choice being the issue, whether it is choice or not, of a life partner and somebody you live with is one of those things that one would like to think is choice, but is determined by serendipity. You can't do the control experiment.
Right now.
There are no control experiments in life. You can, so you don't. I don't know how it would have turned out had I gone to the other university. I don't know. I think that was the one point where the deciding which place to go to was something where the choices became
right.
a little more stark. But even then, I think I made the. I'm not sure that I would have got tenure out of that at some other universities. That choice was well made. Not because I don't think the work in the long run has justified it. I just, the timing wouldn't have been right.
Mm-hmm.
Grant funding is, there's quite a lot of serendipity involved in that, and that has very real consequences.
Mm-hmm.
My last, or the renewal percentile score wasn't all that far above the funding cutoff. Could have gone either way, and I think somebody, a friend with just got a second grant proposal, I think, with pretty much the identical percentile score, but the funding level was on the wrong side.
Mm-hmm.
So probably a better grant than mine, and it didn't get funded. There's a lot of serendipity involved there, or it's reverse.
Right.
I don't. In a geneticist.